You're listening to The Hawk 101.5 FM in Hamilton, Ontario.
You are listening to Bridging the Social Distance. My name is Jenny Mitchell, and I recorded this show here at CFRU, Guelph's campus and community radio station, as a means of creating a platform for us to share ideas and feelings and perspectives in the wake of this global pandemic that is COVID-19. I was afraid that people would get isolated or I would lose the opportunity to chat with my community and find out how everyone is doing, so I made this show. If you're listening and you would like to get involved or be interviewed, you can contact me at mobile@cfru.ca. I'd like to provide the disclaimer that these interviews were recorded at different points in time, so situations in some of these locations may have changed. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Jake Klassen, a resident over at the Village Riverside Glen Retirement Residence. This interview was originally recorded on September 8th, 2020. Would you like to introduce yourself for listeners?
My name is Jake Klassen. I'm 96 years old, and I'm living in the retirement home here.
At Riverside Glen?
Riverside Glen, yes.
How long have you been at Riverside Glen?
Oh, just only months.
Oh,
just
really?
Some months. Yeah, I just came when they had the lockdown or whatever it was, Well, that's when I came, yeah.
Well, to start with, can you maybe tell me a bit about what it was like to move into a new space during a pandemic?
Well, I couldn't go anywhere or have any company. I was just stuck in the room, you might say, and the meals were brought to me. So I didn't get out to mix with the people at all. I just by myself. That's all. It wasn't great.
Yeah. Did that? Is it 14 days? Is that how long they restrict it?
You know, I 14 days, and that was just up, and then they moved in with another 14 days.
Oh right, because there was a scare.
Yeah, so I had 28 days.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a long drag.
Yeah. Where did you move from? What was your lifestyle like before coming here?
I was with my daughter in Woodbridge.
Well, where's Woodbridge?
Where is it?
Yeah.
In Toronto, just on the north end of Toronto.
Okay.
Vaughan is the other name that it goes by. Yeah. And like my wife died and about I think 2011. And she said, why don't you come and live with us? She says, we'll take good care of you. And so I went over there and it's been great over there. They've been very good to me and it's been great. And now I guess it was time that I went to a retirement home. Yeah. And they wanted to do some traveling yet. They're retiring soon, and just to get set up, they thought this would be a nice place for me, and I wouldn't be left alone if they go traveling or something like that.
That makes sense. How did you end up in Guelph?
Oh, my other daughter lives in Guelph.
Oh, okay.
And she's just 15 minutes away from here. And she had she knew about this retirement home and the good comments about it. And she said, let's go in and just have an interview. Just go around and have a look, and everything looked very good. Looked very good. So we decided to come here.
It's kind of neat that you got to spend a bunch of years with one daughter, and then now are closer to the other one. It's kind of a nice trade.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it was nice that she invited me to come and live with them, and I went to see Carol occasionally too, and I have another daughter in Calgary, and I have a son in on the island.
Oh, which island?
Vancouver Island.
Vancouver Island, okay.
Yes.
We have a few islands here in Canada.
Yes, I shouldn't use that word loosely.
I think you're right, though. I think people, when they say the island, are often referring to Vancouver Island. It's very beautiful there.
It is.
So that's a bit of a spread. There's two here in Ontario and two out west. So where did you do the bulk of your growing up?
In Saskatchewan.
Oh, okay. Where in Saskatchewan?
Yeah. Where? Just south of Saskatoon. It's a small town called Dundurn.
Oh, yeah. I know Dundurn.
Is that so?
Well, I've traveled through Saskatchewan a fair bit, and I just discovered Langenberg last time I was there, which was quite a place. But yeah, I've gone through Dundurn on my way across.
Well, is that so? Yeah. Well, that's where I grew up and got my education in the high school there and so on.
Well, can we go back to your Saskatchewan days and can you share with me any stories you have from growing up?
We lived 2 miles from town, from Dundurn, and the railroad track running right through there, and I often walked along that railroad track to go to school, and I had a horse and buggy or a horse and sleigh, and I could leave that at a livery stable in Dundurn and then walk the rest of the way to town to school. You know,
that's neat.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
When you say you had a sleigh, like when, how old would you have been? Would you have been riding alone?
Yes, alone. Yeah. Oh, well, I suppose through my high school, say 14, 15, 16, somewhere in there, is when I would be riding alone. With a horse and a buggy and so on. Yeah.
So would there have been lots of people coming on separate buggies? Would there have been places where all kinds of them would be, like, tied up for the day?
Not a great deal, but there were some, yes. Yeah, there were some that came from outlying districts and different methods, different ways. Some were driven there, others walked, and others had horses and wagons and sleighs and stuff like that too. And yes,
that's really neat. I guess that's the sort of area that now probably a school bus would go grab everybody. That would probably be the modern approach.
Yes, that came in later on, and then there were school buses, yes.
How big of a class do you think you would have had back then? Was it like a range of grades and ages?
Oh, about, I'd say about 10, 12 to a class was probably average.
And a mix of grades?
A mix?
Yeah, like were there different grades in one?
Yes. Yeah. Three grades to one classroom. There were four classrooms.
And so did you stay in Saskatchewan after you were out of high school as well?
Yes. Yes, the war came along. And my father had been conscientious objector, and I took that upon myself too. I wasn't going to go to war and kill people, and so I applied for that. And so they said, well, then you'll have to do alternative service. Well, one of the alternative services was farm work. So I was doing farm work when I finished my high school. And I met my wife, Hilda, at high school, but not at Dundurn. This was at Rostern. The way it turned out, the high school principal quit just a few months before the end of grade 12. Okay. Well, in order, just so that it wouldn't be lost and have to repeat the grade, I went I was offered to go to Rostern, and gotcha. That's where I met Hilda, and a couple of years later we were married. I bought a farm and a half section farm, and moved an old house, two story house. The basement that we had built there with concrete, like
a foundation.
Yes, good foundation, and then slowly we fixed up the house, and lived there permanently. Yeah, half-section farm. Lived there for 20 years.
Wow. Okay, yeah. I have a few questions. Because the conscientious objector, I didn't know that that was an option, and I'm curious what type of farming they had you doing. Like, where would you have been working?
It was a grain farm, grain and cattle too, though.
Okay. Both.
So it was a half section that seeded to wheat, oats, and barley, and had cattle, and I could take them. I didn't have a lot of pasture land, so I was able to take them to a community pasture that the government had set aside. Take them to there every spring, stay there all summer long, and then towards winter, come back to the farm, and I'd have to take care of them there.
So was this a government-owned farm, or was it just that the government needed to ensure that there were enough people continuing to produce food during the war?
It wasn't a government-controlled farm at all,
okay.
No. So it was like you say, they realized that their farmers were essential to get that food to market.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's neat. When I think about it, practically, there must have been all kinds of efforts going on along with the war to make sure that all of the other things that society needs continues to be made, but you don't actually hear about it very much.
I suppose so.
And the you were using a term half something farm, and I'm not sure what that is either.
The half section farm.
Yeah, what is that?
That's I had two quarters of land, and the one quarter is 160 acres.
Oh wow!
So I had 320 acres of land to farm. Yes.
Why do they call it a half section? Is it just a measurement?
Yes, and they like there. It goes a lot by sections. Like the if they talk about any widespread area that the government owns, they'll talk about it being so and so many sections of land.
Okay.
And a section is four quarters. And
okay.
640 acres, yeah.
So did you enjoy farming?
I didn't really.
No?
Really. It was too monotonous, you know, like if you're going around and working in a field and you just go round and round and round and round, and it was monotonous.
Yeah.
It was monotonous. I had other things that I was anxious to do. I was always handy with my hands, and I wanted to make stuff, to do things, you know. Yes. During that time when I was on the farm, my brother stayed on the other farm, and we worked together. I helped him and he helped me, and so we would harvest together. I would go and help him, and then he would come with his machinery and come and do mine, because I didn't have any machinery at that time. Nothing was built up, but I helped him, and so we worked together a lot, and in winter time, and when there wasn't farming to do, we were busy building stuff. Like we had different stuff, grinders and hydraulic presses, and we built for the combine, a sort of an auger effect to catch the chaff, but only the chaff and not the straw from the when it was harvesting. Mm-hmm. And then blow it onto a rack, and that rack was what became the feed for the cattle for winter.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's neat. So you built a lot of those things yourself?
A lot.
Wow.
A lot of stuff, yes. Yes.
Was that ordinary to build your own, or was that because you liked building so much that you worked that in?
Yes, well, that was a big thing, like building it, but also out of need. Couldn't mm-hmm. buy it. We couldn't pay for it. We didn't have the money. Right. We were just down to a bare minimum, just making a living, and that's it.
So your brother was coming over from the family farm, like where you grew up?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes.
So
yes.
Was he older? Did he kind of get to have the farm because he was the older brother?
Yes, my dad died when he was 50 years old.
Wow.
And then my brother was about 10 years older than I was, and he more or less had to run the farm. He had to take over.
Wow. Did you have a lot of siblings?
I had two sisters and two brothers.
Okay. And so when he took over the farm, when your dad passed away, would there still been a lot of family at home at that time?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, my two sisters were still home. My one sister got married. About that time, about shortly after that, and the other sister was working for to make a living. She didn't stay home. She was just busy working for the people in town or wherever they wanted her. Yeah.
So. When you moved over, how did you go about moving that house? How was that done?
that was just put on skids, and then with a big tractor pulling it, it would just skid. It wouldn't be on wheels. It would just be on skids, and just dragging it. But it was about 4.5 miles that had to be moved.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was moved in that distance, and then put onto the foundation.
So was that a normal thing to do, or was that also kind of an innovation on your part?
Well, I suppose it wasn't. It wasn't that was that common, but if something had to be moved, it would be put on skids often and just moved to where it was necessary. That was one way of moving it. Yes.
So the house that you found would have just been on a different property that wasn't being used, or like how would you acquire a house to move back then?
The house wasn't in use anymore. He'd built a new house.
Okay.
And it belonged to a farmer that, I believe he was the one that had farmed that half section previously. Mm. So he was. I was familiar with his name and that he had this house there and it was actually it was being used for a bit of a granary. He had some grain stored in it for a while and some of it. Yeah.
Can you describe the house to me? I'm trying to visualize, like, whether this is a tiny little hut that is dragged for 4 miles or a big old farmhouse. What did it look like?
Well, you should think more of a bigger house, two-story, mind you.
Okay.
Two-story, and with I don't know if it's two-story, it should give you an idea about how tall it was.
Yep.
So there was four different rooms. There was a bedroom and another bedroom a little over, and on the other side was a kitchen.
Okay.
So that had to have those dimensions.
Okay.
And there were windows in the sides at the bottom. Actually, on top too, it was narrower, or it had the peak roof, and so it only had a window in the center there. But at the bottom part, there was at the corners there were the windows.
Okay, that's a good visual.
Is that all right?
Yeah. I've been in some old farmhouses. I love the idea that because you moved it there, you get to decide what way you're going to see when you look out a window. You know, it's kind of a really neat part of. I don't know. I guess I don't know anybody who's moved a house. Oh, that's not true. I know one person out east who they moved a house up the hill in a very tiny little Nova Scotia town, but it's not very common these days. So usually you just move into a house, it looks where it looks, and it's just, it's nice picturing it.
Well, I can tell you a funny little story about our house. We had a bedroom, and it was in a corner, and there were two there were two windows, a window on each corner like that. And the whole house was about a couple of hundred yards away from the road. on the other side of the window was facing the pasture land there, where, and anyway, every night for going to bed, we had roller blinds, you know, the kind that you can pull down like that. Mm-hmm. An elder would pull them down for every night for going to bed, you know. And it was so quiet out there. There was seldom a car even drove by. And when it did, it just whizzed by and wouldn't notice it. And I said, why are we wearing out the blinds, pulling those blinds down when we go to bed, when there's nobody going by and there's just pasture on the other side? And, well, she finally gave in to the pasture land side, but on the road side, she always pulled it before that. Well, this one night, it was sort of a rainy night, and all of a sudden there was a knock on the door.
Okay.
And my goodness, how come the dog didn't notice, you know? And because we had a dog and he would notice that. Well, anyway, I went to the door, and here it was a car dealer from Hanley, which was a little south of Dundurn, and he had slipped into the ditch. So slippery, slipped in a ditch. So I went and started my tractor, gave him a pull, and sent him on his way. And then when we got back, Hilda says, you know, did you realize that with this, he hadn't walked along the road. He couldn't walk there. It was too muddy and slippery. He'd walked along the pasture land. He'd come right by our window that was open. And she says, did you realize that I was just getting undressed at that time? What's he going to think? You know what I said? That lucky Jake.
That's a good story.
So that sort of became my nickname, Lucky Jake.
You're listening to Bridging the Social Distance, a show recorded here in Guelph at CFRU as a platform for sharing stories and perspectives during the global pandemic of COVID-19. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Jake Klassen, a resident at the Village of Riverside Glen Retirement Residence.
Did she start rolling the blinds down again?
Probably. I don't remember. I don't remember, but anyway,
that's really funny. Of all the, I just it's funny when you think like, yeah, it seems impossible that anyone would ever go through the field, and there it is, one day, one person.
Yeah, and the reason the dog hadn't barked was because when the commotion was on the road, he went to the road to listen. To see when somebody would come on the driveway. And he missed this chap that was going on the grass and just came up right beside our house, right past our window, and then went to the door and knocked on the door. And Hilda was so embarrassed. You know, what a thing.
Lucky to.
Lucky to have her.
Aw, I love that. That's a good tip for if there was somebody who was going to be a burglar in the night to cause a commotion at the road to distract the dogs and then go around another way.
That's it,
Yeah. What era of, I'm not very good at math. And so if you're 96 and this was when you finished high school, you farmed during the war, and then this was after that, right? So I'm trying to guess, would it have been about 70 years ago? Is that approximately right?
Well, this happened when I got married at 21.
21, okay.
Yeah, and this happened shortly after, maybe when I was 22 or so.
Okay.
And so 22 from 96.
Yeah.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, I farmed for 20 years. We ran the farm. And then moved to Saskatoon, bought a brand new house, sold our cattle, and rented out the farm. And moved to Saskatoon, and I worked in a machine shop.
So this would have been when you were in your 40s, I guess.
Yes, when I was in my 40s.
What happened? What sparked the move? Because I know you said you didn't really love farming, but you still managed to do it for 20 years. So what changed in your 40s?
Well, I was going to night classes, taking machine shop courses. And in the meantime, my brother had bought a small lathe and a welder, and we were building stuff, and I was actively involved in machine shop stuff, and I felt I could make a living working in a machine shop better than on the farm, and something that I would enjoy more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and while I was working in a machine shop, I worked at getting my machinist papers, and I got to be a journeyman machinist.
Oh, what's a journeyman machinist? Can I ask what that is?
What is someone who works with lathes and milling machines and with metal?
Okay.
And while I was working with that, they talked about teaching the trade, teaching machine shop, and so I applied there and found out that I was second or third a number of times when I applied for a teaching job like that. And I asked, these people that got in instead of me, had they gone to university? And it turned out they had. So I decided to go to university for a year. And I went to university for a year, got my journeyman's teaching certificate, and applied for the job. And in the meantime, my daughter was living in Edmonton, and she saw this ad for a machinist teacher. Sent it to me, and I applied, but I didn't think I'd ever make it. But I was called to Edmonton for an interview, and here I walked in this big hallways and those beautiful places. I just couldn't believe that I'd ever be able to teach in there, And so I had my interview and went home. They said they'd let me know soon. And I was just home one day, and they called and they offered me the job.
Wow.
A temporary position for 1 year.
Okay.
And So I went and took the position. I couldn't believe it, but I, lucky Jake, I made it. And at the end of the year, though, the time was up, and I couldn't, and that was it. Mm-hmm. So I applied at a number of different places. I even applied at high schools, and they called from Alberta for the high school.
Oh.
And so I accepted it. They even moved me, and I taught there for 2 years. And in the meantime, they called me and they wanted me back in Edmonton. And so I went to Edmonton, and I stayed there and taught there until I retired at 60.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you like Alberta after having lived in Saskatchewan so long?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I like the atmosphere. I like the teaching. I enjoy teaching.
Yeah, that's a really neat, it's, you know, I can picture you working on a farm and that type of monotony, not feeling like a good fit and wanting to build things, but teaching is like a whole other arc, and it's kind of neat that you discovered that too, that not just building things, but teaching other people how to do that. And yeah. It must be kind of fun in high school too, when... You know, people are figuring out if that's something they want to do for the rest of their life or just something they want to know how to do alongside other things.
You know, at that time, I didn't realize that my life was going to be turned that way.
Yeah.
I didn't think that I was going to be teaching. It just evolved.
Yeah.
Just as I went, it just evolved that way. And yes. And the teaching, I enjoyed teaching the students too, you know, to improve themselves. And they would come and actually I taught apprentices as well. Oh. What I was teaching more than grades as opposed in a high school or something like that.
Right.
These apprentices, do you know what an apprentice is?
Yeah, so that would be somebody who is going to work in the field. And they'd be following, like shadowing and learning the real skill set, right? Getting ready to be able to be certified as their own.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have it right. Yeah. Yeah. And then each year there might be some improvement stuff, you know, just an advancement. Yeah. And they would learn that from me and then go back to their boss.
Yeah. Was when you were like back then, if you were a machinist, did you get kind of different certificates for different types of machines? So maybe at first you know how to do milling, but now you also have taken on, like, did it expand like that?
It includes the whole works.
Okay.
As a machinist, you have experience with all those machines at some point or another. Yes.
Okay. Did you have a favorite, though? Like a favorite type of machine or type of thing to build?
Oh, I think probably the lathe is the most enjoyable in that you're capable of such minute diameters when you're machining stuff. With milling, it's just grinding away material, but you're not you don't have the accuracy that you do and the finish that you get from a lathe.
Would you normally do both? Like, would you use a mill first to kind of rough it out and then a lathe to do the nuanced bits?
Oh, it just depends on the size, the diameter of what you've got, and how much you have to machine off. But the lathe is quite capable of reducing the diameter of something whereas you wouldn't use a milling machine to do that.
Yet. Sure.
The lathe is quite capable of really roughing it out and reducing something, yeah.
How were the machines powered at that point in time?
With electric motors.
Electric motors?
Oh, yeah.
I grew up working in my dad's thrift store, an antique store, and you could tell when you got the furniture that was made, like, nicer. Like, it really instilled an appreciation in me in the stuff that was made by hand or made on machines but by a person versus later when everything just kind of came out looking like a factory. Because we'd get all kinds. You'd get, like, a really nice, beautiful headboard, and you'd look at all of the little details, and it's something that, like, only a person could do. And you knew that even if they were making more than one, it would never be exactly the same. They would all be a little bit unique. And, you know, later things just came that just looked like somebody just kind of printed them or something, and it really is not the same.
Yeah, well, that's true.
I would have loved to have seen those machines in action back in the day. They were probably really neat-looking machines, too.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
It's quite impressive. It's bigger, different sizes for different jobs that have to be done. Yes.
So when you would normally go work for, like, if you were a machinist, you'd usually be working for some sort of company that has a lot of equipment themselves. It'd probably be pretty rare for people to have their own machines, I guess, right?
Yes. Yes, they wouldn't have that. They'd more or less have to work for some company or person who had had accumulation of those machines.
Yeah. Because they probably took up a lot of room, too, right? Like, these would have been big factory-style spaces with these different machines going?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they take up quite a lot of room, yes.
Where did you teach out of when you were teaching? Like, did they set up a space that simulated a shop?
No, and classrooms. And then that would only be for classroom stuff.
Okay.
If there were some demonstrations, maybe on a film, you know, maybe on a.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
You could show them some of what is done without them having to be at an actual machine to do it.
Yes.
And I guess they'd go back to wherever they were working to and get to use the real machines.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And maybe they'd seen some of it in action. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm, again, trying to do the math. By the time you retired, was teaching the part of your professional life that ended up being the biggest part?
Yes.
I guess so, eh?
Yes.
It's really neat. Because I do a little bit of teaching in radio. I go into schools and we'll do little radio workshops with students. And I'm 35. So just picturing sort of the timeline of when you shifted and it kind of started a whole new chapter of your life. I really like hearing about that because it's like you don't know what the future holds, but it's neat to hear that a whole other life and even like one that was the dominant amount of time could happen after a whole life of farming. Like 20 years sounds like a lifetime to me. And so, that's really neat. And Hilda was along for the journey. She didn't mind switching track from farm life to city life.
She was just with it, whatever it took towards, She did get her own job too, after some time, and she was working in the jewelry department, which that suited her very nicely. She loved jewelry. She loved nice things. Yes.
Well, how many children did you have? You had four, you said, right? Is that right?
Four, yes.
Four. So yes. When you moved and were teaching in Edmonton, would most of your children have been older than school age by then anyway? Or did some of them have to switch from, like, going to school in Saskatoon to going to school in the city?
Oh, yes.
Yeah?
Yes. Yes, definitely.
Because you mentioned your one daughter was already in Edmonton, right?
Yes. Yes, the oldest one, yes.
And so when did Ontario happen? Like the move to Ontario?
That happened after my wife died.
Okay.
Yes.
So one of your daughters, well, I guess two of your daughters had moved here. And so you came out here from out west at that point?
Yes.
Okay. Was that a big transition? Like, had you spent any time in Ontario really before that?
No, I hadn't spent any time in Ontario at all.
That was only about 9 years ago, right?
Yeah.
What did you think of the move?
Well, it suited me that it was family. I didn't have to be by myself. I just lost Hilda. I just lost my wife. So I wasn't a happy person. I was still suffering from that. But I had the love of a daughter that I was living with. And Carol, who was just 100 kilometers away in Guelph. And I went to see Vic every summer for a couple of weeks. I would fly down and stay with him and maybe rent a wheelchair or something like that. By that time, the nerves in my feet were shot, and I couldn't stand around a long time, and had trouble walking, like a walker would support me, and then I would manage. And in the meantime, they bought me a three-wheeled bicycle, and it's just great. I can pedal. I can pedal on that without hurting my legs. I get my exercise in my legs, so that's. That's just about as if I was walking, that much exercise, and I can just coast around on the stuff, on the sidewalks all over the place, you know, and really enjoy it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I hadn't thought. I meet lots of people living at Riverside Glen, and. Yeah, and if they're in the one particular part of the building, they usually need some sort of support, like a wheelchair or something. But it's neat because your legs are still capable of getting you around. It's just your nerves, I guess, that get in the way. So the bike is like a perfect solution.
It's a perfect solution.
That's so neat.
Yeah.
It's still very impressive to me that you would fly all the way out west and rent a wheelchair. Like, I know a lot of people that when their legs... go, that's sort of the end of the chapter of traveling. And so I still think that's very impressive.
Well, this just made it possible so that I could follow my son around.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever he was doing, I would be there and I could help him with my hands or something like that, or just just for the fun of it, to be there. It was so nice that I was able to be there with him for...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite part of Canada in terms of, like, the visual part or environment part?
Well, I think Vancouver Island is really the most beautiful, and the temperature wise, it's so moderate, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, really nice.
Yeah, I think that's a good choice. I have a hard time choosing between there and the East Coast. There's some really beautiful parts of New Brunswick and Nova Scotia too, but Vancouver Island is really something else. Tofino, yeah, with the old growth forests, it really feels like a whole other planet when you're there. It's, yeah, really wild.
Yeah. I've been to the East Coast years ago. I had a trailer and a friend and his wife joined us, and we made the trip with a trailer and all the way to the East Coast and back again. So we have a taste of it. Very friendly people out east.
Yeah.
So it was nice making that trip. But I think Vancouver Island would still be my favorite.
Yeah. Fair enough. I respect that decision. Well, I guess we're getting close to the end of the hour. I have a couple questions I've been asking most people, and one is around support. So as a person who's just moved into Riverside Glen a short time ago, I'm curious if there's ways either that you have felt supported since moving, or if you have advice to people out there as to a way we could be supporting people who are making big transitions during this challenging time. Do you have any sort of advice or suggestions for ways we could be supporting our loved ones if they have to make a move like this?
Well, I can't off the top of my head. I'd have to have time to think about it. And
is there something that has helped the transition for you?
Well, I don't know. I can't say exactly. I like humor. I like jokes, and my son knows that, and he often sends me funnies that I have on my iPad, and I might have a dozen, and I find that is really great to humor. I like humor. I like to have jokes and have fun.
I think that's a great answer, by the way. That seems like a simple thing that we could be passing along, you know? You see something funny, and then maybe there's somebody in your life that wants a laugh as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, how about silver linings? Has there been anything that has been a sort of positive, like a... something that you've seen emerge during the pandemic, maybe even just for other people in your life or the greater world, any change that you've seen happen during this time that you think is something that's kind of a positive part of this otherwise negative part that you'd love to see continued? I know I'm putting you on the spot. What have you been doing at Riverside Glen to pass the time?
Oh, I read a lot. I have a little feeder for little birds, and then grackles came in and took over, and they were fighting for those seeds, and they were just awful. They just I just didn't like them, and finally they finished what was there, the seeds, and I haven't replenished them because I didn't want them back again. And now I have a little hummingbird feeder there, and it's been there now for, oh, I don't know, a long time. And I look and check it occasionally, and you know, it was last night at about 6:45, the tiniest little hummingbird was sitting there, and then he would fly away, fly a little bit like that, and he was just hovering in there and getting that sugar water, and I was so pleased to see him finally after all this time. There was a hummingbird.
Wow!
I was told that the best thing probably would be early in the spring, if that's out, and they get used to it when they fly around and looking for something like this, for flowers and stuff. And this is the end of the season, you know, so it was sort of unusual, but I was just so pleased with that. That little hummingbird.
I love that. All you need is one little hummingbird to go back and tell the rest, right? And then next spring, they'll all come ready for it.
Maybe so.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I'm really glad you got to see that. That's a really special moment.
I'm just so pleased with that, yeah.
Well, it's been really wonderful chatting with you. I'm really glad that you took the time to share stories with me today.
Oh, I'm just so pleased that you were interested in some of my...
Oh, I love it, yeah. Do you get to go out on your trike again yet? Is it the three-wheeler? I don't know what they call the trikes, but do you get to go out again now?
Every morning I go out at about 10 o'clock. I go out for a ride.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's another thing I'm glad you got to do before the weather got too cold.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Well, I'm glad some of these things get to stay on during the tricky days.
Yeah.
Well, it was really nice to meet you. I suppose I have to let you go, but thanks so much. I really enjoyed this. And I'm going to come visit in person at some point when they allow that again. And Bryce says you have some stained glass you could show me.
Oh, I've got all kinds of stained glass to show you.
I would love that.
That was my hobby for years. And I've got I did so many projects. Yes. Yeah, I'd love to show you my stained glass.
I would love to see it. That gives me something to look forward to.
All right.
Okay. Bye, Jake.
Bye-bye. Thank you so much for it.
You too. So once again, that was Jake Klassen, a resident at the Village of Riverside Glen Retirement Residence. That brings us to the end of this episode of Bridging the Social Distance, a show produced at CFRU in Guelph and syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario, that aims to create a platform for us sharing what we are doing to get through this time together in the wake of COVID-19.